did it nice. Yeah. But is he anyway, a couple things real quick. Reminder on the books out there. One of them is for archives, and then the other one is for tomorrow. So if you don't care, write your name and sobriety date in it and whatnot. That way we can have archives and have a gift to give tomorrow. So anyway, and then the other thing, we got our other two speakers have came. Marion from Knoxville, yeah. And her bodyguard. Her bodyguard's here too. And then we got Adam T. from Los Angeles. Yeah. And then his girlfriend from, I think, Indianapolis. Yay. Thank you for coming down. Yay. Okay. All right. Our first speaker is going to be speaking on steps 1 and 2. And, man, Zach is just full of energy, and there's nobody loves D.A. more than Zach. I mean, and it ain't because how he's vocal. It's about his actions in it. He's everywhere in it. So, all right, Zach, come on up.
Wow, it is so amazing to be here, and I really, really mean that. My name is Zach Zeter, and I'm a very grateful recovered drug addict. How's it going? Like was said, I owe my life to Drug Addicts Anonymous, and I'm forever grateful for Drug Addicts Anonymous and how I was connected to God through these 12 steps. This is a surreal moment for me, to be honest with you. So if I get a little bit emotional or something, just forgive me. I'm not trying to be a big crybaby or whatever, but a little history, and I'll weave it in, and I'll start getting into steps 1 and 2. Don't you worry about that. There's a couple people in the room. My good dear friend Clint is here, and he was on the first committee that started planning the very first Drug Addicts Anonymous conference with me. We started talking about it in 2015. I was standing there after our meeting, and I was talking to my sponsor and another guy, and I said, "Hey, man, I'm just kind of curious. You always hear about all these Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous and all these other things that have conferences and conventions and all that, and we're pretty hardcore. We're all about the steps and this and that, and just do what you got to do to be free and everything. And I'm a firm believer in that. But I said, is there anything that goes on in Drug Addicts Anonymous?" And I said, "I don't know. I never heard of anything." And so I started looking up on my phone and looking online and stuff. And I saw one or two people that had like a local barbecue for their meeting or something like that. And couldn't find anything about a state convention or a national conference or a world conference or anything like that. And I said, we ought to come together and pray about it and work on it and do it, and we did. And that was in 2015. And the first one we had was in 2016. And it was hilarious, guys. I mean, it was beautiful, but it was hilarious because I remember that, like, we had these speakers come in, and we looked like we were at a, like, high school or middle school science fair. All right, we had these little tables with like trifold posters with like handwritten stuff on it and everything, and it was awesome. But there might have been, I don't know, 15 or 20 people that came through, and some of them are here too from South Florida. And I got up there to do my talk, and there was like 3 or 4 people in the room. It was like my sponsor, my sponsee, and one guy from my home group, And I was like, "Y'all, should I even do this? I mean, should we just like go get some lunch, man, and say we did it? Because this is kind of weird." And they're like, "No, go for it," And I'm just, "All right, I'll talk to you three." It was weird, man, but it was so cool. And anyways, what I'm just saying is it never ceases to amaze me the people that God uses to do things. And many of them are in this room right now. And all we need to do is have a little bit of willingness and a little bit of stick-to-itiveness and just keep plowing and just keep going. And when there's nobody there, keep going. And when there's lots of people there, remember that there wasn't anybody there and just give thanks and just keep going. And, you know, you get something going like that and you feel kind of like a little bit protective over it. But you're not supposed to be in these fellowships. You're supposed to just let it go, you know, and just see what happens. And when a group came down in 2019 from Tennessee, man, they had their stuff together. They already had those shirts. Those shirts are like 2 years old, y'all. Those shirts are like 2 years old. I got one when they came down to Florida. They were like ready. And so this is the fifth conference, but it's the sixth year because obviously last year nothing happened. And we just said, man, we're all in Drug Addicts Anonymous. Y'all take it. Go for it. And here we are today. So just to walk into a room, and can we just put our hands together for the committee that planned this thing? The amount of thankless work that goes into stuff like this is unbelievable. You have got to experience it for yourself. It's like usually like a small group of people on the committee do most of the work. Half of them are gone by the time you even have the thing. And it's just crazy. And I just know it's a miracle that we're here. And standing in a room full of so many people that shouldn't even be alive, that gives me goosebumps. Not only are we all alive, but we all came here to talk about God and to talk about the solution, to hear how to get free and how to do this stuff. And that never ceases to amaze me. So I just wanted to go into that for a minute and just give a little history and just say how unreal it is for me to be here with you guys and how thankful and grateful I am, because that's the truth. I got sober in Drug Addicts Anonymous. I had been through, like, so many of us, a bunch of treatment centers, a bunch of IOPs, a bunch of detoxes, a little homeless shelter, a few trips to jail, a couple times to the hospital, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I had been to all the other fellowships, and this time I got clean, and there was a guy who I was in rehab with. And it's hard for me to tell a little bit of my story without mentioning him, because this guy, he was a genius. I mean, literally, he had a genius level IQ, and he was a psychologist. That was his job. He solved other people's problems for a living. But his family had to leave him with shit in his pants and puke on his shirt, sitting on the curb at an ABC liquor store, and go back to Japan where they were from, because he couldn't stop drinking to save his life or his pancreas or anything. And I was in rehab with him. And we were in detox. We had the same sober date. And we were in detox together. And my family came to visit me. And the dude was in scrubs, right? He was walking around in scrubs. And he was so smart. He could just tell you a story. And you'd be like, wow, that's so interesting. I mean, he spoke like in 1930s English. You know what I mean? Like, he was just so smart, everything he said. And he walks up to my family. And he's like, you know, I'm very pleased with how Zach's treatment is coming along. And, you know, he seems to really be connecting the dots here. And, you know, I'm very optimistic about the outcome of his long term or whatever. And he's like talking to my family, and they're like, wow, we're really glad to hear that or whatever. And the nurse comes up and she goes, Keith, come on, it's time for your meds. And it takes him away. And my dad was like, what the hell? What is going on in here, man? And he always tells that story, and it's so awesome. But this guy, man, he was in rehab with me, and he had never been to a rehab, and he was a staunch atheist, okay? And there's nothing wrong with that, you know? I mean, nothing against anybody, but that was what he was. And as a matter of fact, one of his favorite things to do was to talk to people and make them feel absolutely stupid if they believed in God in any way, of any sort. That was like his favorite thing to do, was just to talk to you, twist your mind around, prove to you why you were wrong, why you were weak for even considering that, how silly that was, and just make you feel like an idiot. He just loved it. It like got him high. And we were in he got out of there before me because his insurance runs out. His insurance ran out, and so he calls me up one day. We had phones. This was in 2009, and there was little phones in our apartments that we were in. And he calls me up one day, and he's like, "Hey, what's up, man?" And he was all jacked up, and I'm like, "Dude, what is going on?" Because he was very grumpy in rehab. You know what I mean? He was very, very grumpy, easily agitated. And he's all fired up, and I'm like, "What's happening, dude?" And he says, "I'm working the steps, man. I'm working the steps." I'm like, "Well, how far could you have possibly gotten? You've only been gone for like 2 weeks, you know what I mean? 2 or 3 weeks or whatever." And he's like, "Man, I just did my fifth step yesterday, and I'm having a spiritual experience." And I'm like, "Hold up. Are you drunk?" You know what I mean? Because he was a straight juicer. And I said, "Are you drunk, dude? Because you just said spiritual experience, and I'm having trouble tracking you here." You know what I mean? And he said, "Yeah, I know it's crazy, but you know, God's doing something." I was like, "All right, man, here's the deal. You need to get me in contact with whoever you're talking to, because I need to do whatever you're doing, you know?" And I had been in and out of the rooms. I had probably been to 1,000 meetings, you know, court ordered, not court ordered, in rehab, not in rehab. I tried doing 360 and 180, because I thought 90, and you know, I went to like 2 a day for 6 months, and I'd get drunk before and high after, and you know, and it was all, I was that dude like throwing pieces of paper at the chairperson and like disrupting meetings and stuff like that. I mean, dude, it was bad. It was bad. And so I go to this guy, and I had never in my life had somebody just pull me aside and qualify me and ask me if I wanted to get started in the steps that week. It was a brand new experience for me. I had been to so many meetings, and I had had so many people that say they'd be my sponsor, and we'd go to Starbucks, right? And they'd buy me a Starbucks. And that's beautiful. And I knew that these guys cared about me because they gave up their time to come and sit with me, right? And so, I mean, that's amazing, just in and of itself. But they'd say stuff to me like, "Well, Zach, how's it going?" And I'd say, "Well, not so good, man. You know, I mean, what are you?" And they'd say, "Well, are you thinking about getting high?" "Yeah. Yeah, I am. I'm thinking about getting high right now." You know what I mean? And they'd say stuff, well, "Have you called everybody in your phone?" "No. No, I haven't. I'm here, dude. Like, what do you want from me? I'm here, you know?" And they'd say stuff like, "Just don't use, no matter what. Just don't do it, you know?" And I "All right, man. You know, like, I mean, I hear you. That sounds like a great idea. I've been trying that for a long time. I guess I'll just keep trying. You know what I mean? I don't know what to tell you." And they tell me stuff like, "You got your white chip in your pocket?" This one guy had me carry around my white chip and carry it in my pocket. And I said, "Yeah, I got it with me, like you told me to," or whatever. "I'm trying to do whatever you say, even though you're telling me to do a bunch of weird shit." And he's like, "All right, here's what happens. If you want to get high or drunk, you take that white chip out and you put it in your mouth. And if it dissolves, you could take a drink." You know what I mean? I'm like, "Dude, what is this, man? What are you talking to me about? You know, like, I know it's not going to dissolve, you know, whatever, man. You know, if I want to do it, I'm going to do it. And what do you got for me?" And they'd tell me to go to meetings, and they nobody ever just got into it with me. Nobody ever rolled up their sleeves and showed me what was in this book. And so, like a lot of people in this room, what's really cool is I'm mostly preaching to the choir in here, because everybody in here is a bunch of big book thumpers, and you know, they're hardcore. There's no watered down stuff going on in here. So I feel at home, like maybe I won't get any tomatoes thrown at me or whatever, you know, I don't know. Brad might throw a tomato at me. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. But he showed me, man. He showed me. And so it's so important for me. Like, if you go back and you study the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, which gave birth to Drug Addicts Anonymous, and you look at what they did, it'll amaze you. Because you know what? The first 100, they didn't even do what's the best that we can do now, which is work the steps out of this book. Because guess what? They didn't even have one. The first 100 didn't have a big book. So they didn't get a sponsor and read the book, and they didn't do that. Not a single one of them even did 12 steps. Most of them did 6 and different things. You can find it. I'm going to reference it later on page 263. You can find some of the stuff that Dr. Bob used from the Oxford group to work people through. They used a lot of scripture. They did a lot of prayer. They would work people through the steps in an afternoon or in a week or two. Usually, a month or two tops. I mean, Ebbie Thatcher, it was referenced earlier. That was Bill W.'s sponsor. He wasn't even in AA. He was in the Oxford group, and he was 2 months sober, and he was 12-stepping Bill to stay sober. And there wasn't all this weird stuff that we've all gotten, all this jargon and psychobabble and all these bizarre sayings and all this, just this cloud of mystery around the steps and stuff. It was just, hey, come on over. Let me show you this thing. You ready to do this? Is this you? Yep. You think this could work? Yep. Let's give it over. Let's write some stuff down. Let's go over it. Bam. You go make it right. You better start helping people like tomorrow or you're going to die, you know? And it was just like, okay. All right. You know what I mean? And so that's the reason that, you know, I don't worship these 12 steps. I'm just thankful to God for them. You know, I know that even Carl Jung told Roland Hazard that here and there throughout history, people have been having what are called vital spiritual experiences. You know, AA didn't create God. God gave us AA and Drug Addicts Anonymous in this big book. And the first 100 wrote down for us what they did so that we could get what they've got by doing what they did. And that's why this is our most valuable tool that we possess, is this big book right here. Because we can actually look at it and read their experiences and follow the clear-cut instructions in the book. So, you know, if you came to a meeting in the first probably 20 years of AA, but definitely in the first 5 to 15 years of AA, I imagine, and from what I've read and looked up on, it was quite different than a lot of our meetings. Now, our goal in this movement here to kind of get back to the basics is to get back to that way. Like people were talking, you know, raising your hand. Who wants to sponsor? We're going to find you a sponsor here tonight. And talking about the solution and talking out of the book. But you didn't come there because you just wanted a place where you knew people had to be your friend. You didn't come there because you knew that there was a place where you heard that they went bowling afterwards on Friday night and that you might get some good cookies and some warm coffee and maybe meet some cute girls that were as sick as you. And you know what I mean? Like that wasn't it, man. It was like it was like a bat symbol, you know, out into it was a pillar of hope. It was a refuge for those that needed to be here. Like, you know, we're talking about the fellowship that we crave. Well, there is a difference between 12-step fellowships and other organizations. If you have a restaurant or a church or a gym or a store or something like that, you know what you want? You want everybody and their mama to come to what you've got. You want everybody there. Why would you not? This is good. This is great. Everybody can benefit from it. Come to my gym. Come to my church. Come to my restaurant. Come to my store. That's not really our goal in here. We don't want to just get as big as we can and just get everybody in here just to be awesome. We want to be here for the people that need to be here. The thing is we know that there's a whole hell of a lot of them, you know? And so we want to be here with a message that carries depth and weight that when people come here, they learn the truth about themselves and they learn exactly what they can do about it to recover, you know? So you go to one of these old school meetings. A lot of times they wouldn't even let you talk unless you had been through the steps. You come in. I've got a problem, right? I don't know how to stop drinking. I don't know how to stop getting high. I don't know what to do. All right, well, you sit there, buddy, and we're going to talk about it because we've recovered. And we're going to ask you at the end of the meeting, is that you? You're going to know for sure. You're not going to know that this guy hates his boss and that lady's cat's sick. And you're not going to know any of that. You're going to know what it means to be a chronic, real alcoholic drug addict. And you're going to know exactly what to do about it. And you're going to be asked, is that you? And do you want to do this? And not a single one of them is going to say, just keep coming back and not doing anything. They're going to say, do you want to do this? And if you say no, well, then they say, maybe we love you. The door is always open. This might take a bunch of times and a bunch of tries, but let us know when you're interested in doing what we say works. And then you come back. You come back anytime. But you would feel really weird sitting in one of those meetings for months and months and months not doing anything. Because all anybody would be talking about is what it means to be a chronic, real drug addict, alcoholic, and asking you if you wanted to do it. And if you said no, they'd kind of just be like, well, dude, well then what are you doing? Why are you here? Why are you here if you don't want to do this or you don't think you need to be here? You know, so it was loving, but it was just kind of like, it wasn't this whole like, hey, let's just go and hang out. And I'm just going to kind of sit in the crowd and just kind of sniff around and just hang out for years and not do anything. It was very much like, this is what we can do about this. Are you interested? And so we know that as chronic drug addicts, there is no bottom. There is no bottom that teaches us our lesson. We don't ever finally learn our lesson. It doesn't happen. It doesn't matter what happens to you. You know, that you got your arm amputated and you went to prison and got shanked and ate out of dumpsters and overdosed 27 times in 4 days and lost everything and got, you know, whatever. That might keep you sober for a little bit, but what it really does is it creates this window of opportunity. You got this window of opportunity. And what we know about chronic drug addicts is that it's not a question of if, but when. We will use again. We will use again, no matter what, because the malady has not been solved. We still have that malady, right? And so when we have that window of opportunity with somebody, what we give them, it actually really, 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 really matters. You know, it matters a lot. And there's a lot of people in here that are really passionate about that and having strong home groups where when people have that window and they show up and they want to know what to do about it, they actually hear it. And they actually get somebody that's going to show them what to do. So what does it mean? What does it mean to be a chronic drug addict? I'm charged with talking about step one and step two. All right. Step one is not a step that you work. It's a place that you arrive in. It's a place that you arrive in. There's not a whole lot of work to be done. As a matter of fact, I heard one guy say it one time. I thought it was hilarious. He's like, if your sponsor's working on step one with you, it means he's out in the parking lot getting high with you. You know, I was like, I see what you're saying, man. That's hilarious, you know. I mean, I come into the room and I just need an explanation. I need somebody to qualify me. I need to know the truth about myself. And then I just need to say, yep, that's me. Or, I don't really think so. I think if I really wanted to stay clean, I could. I think if I wanted to just use a little bit, I could. Okay, all right, well then go do it, brother. We'll be here. I hope you can. You know, we're not haters. We're not like hoping that people fail so that when they come back, we go, ha, I told you. No, we're just like, dude, if you can do that, rock on, brother. I hope you can. I cannot. So if you're like me, you come on back when you figure it out, you know, and that's it. And, you know, so it's this place that we arrive. And I'm going to talk about step one as it's written in the 12 steps because that's what we're supposed to do. But I really love, like I was mentioning earlier, on page 263 in your fourth edition, you can find, is this not a fourth edition? Uh-oh. What is this? Oh, it's a third. Oh, Lord, I don't know what page it's on then. Anyways, at least I know what it says. On page 263 in your fourth edition big books, you will find it there. If you have a third, I don't know what page it's on. But it lists the six steps that Dr. Bob says he formally took me through, the six-step program as it was in that time. He had an afternoon off. And guess what step one was? Complete deflation. Complete deflation. I think that it's one of the most important parts about arriving at a step one place. That place where you're not like, well, listen, man, you know, I know that, you know, heroin is bad and crack is bad, but, you know, I think that I can smoke weed, or I think that I can just drink a little beer and watch football or whatever. Or you're not, like, drawing lines in the sand and comparing yourself to other people. You don't think that you can still do it. You're completely deflated. Like, imagine a tire that's just been and it's just sitting on the rim. There's nothing left. I mean, when I came in this time, for me to accept this message, what was in this book, and actually be interested and willing in taking the actions that are listed in the book, I had to be totally convinced that I wasn't cool enough, I wasn't tough enough, I wasn't mentally strong enough, I didn't have another plan up my sleeve, I wasn't charming enough, I wasn't sneaky enough, I couldn't talk good enough. Even my survival skills, which I took great pride in, were failing me, and I couldn't even survive anymore, and I was broken, and I was completely deflated, and I was absolutely convinced that I could not stay clean on my own fruition, and that if I didn't get some help, I was going to use again, and it was going to be bad, and that my days were numbered. Okay? That was me. Now, the book doesn't say anything about consequences. It says, if when we honestly wanted to, we found we couldn't quit entirely, or if when using we found we had little control over the amount we take, then we're probably a drug addict. Okay, so it doesn't say anything about eating out of dumpsters or going to prison or getting stabbed or whatever. But you in step one, you come to this place where there's nothing left. There's nothing left. And the book, step one in the 12 steps, which is what we're here to talk about, we admitted we were powerless over narcotics and all other mind-altering substances. That's the Drug Addicts Anonymous first part of the first step. So I want to talk about that for a minute. All right, the book is very clear. It talks about, in the doctor's opinion, that we chronic types suffer from a physical allergy called a craving. Okay, the book does reference the craving a couple of times in some other places about the way that I hear it a lot these days about like a desire to use, but that's not what it's talking about in the doctor's opinion. The craving is what happens once I put it into my body. I want more. I want more. I don't just want more. I need more. You know, I need more like I'm out in the desert and you put a drop of water on my tongue and I need more. You know, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes. Now, this physical piece, it says that we use essentially because we like the effect produced. Okay, so that just right there is a myth buster to a lot of different things. I have done some weird stuff, guys. Has anybody ever heard of Passages Malibu? I was a drug addict. Now I'm not. Well, I called that place. It was pretty messed up. It was pretty messed up because I was totally clean and sober, but I pretended that I was in a closet shooting heroin, and that, you know, that I don't even have a wife, that my wife was out in the other room and all this stuff. And I was like, what can you do for me? You know, and I was trying to get to the bottom of like, well, you said you were a drug addict and that you're not now, you know, and I was trying to like figure out how that was possible, you know, and how you could teach me controlled using, you know, or whatever. And what this says, we use essentially because we like the effect produced. What it does is it crushes the idea that I use because of trauma, childhood trauma, or because, you know, it's physical, man. I'm not saying that that stuff doesn't play a part. I'm not saying that those reasons aren't reasons some people get started. I'm not saying that those things, when they happen, don't propel our usage or make it worse. I'm not saying that we don't have to go to therapy and get through those things to be helpful to get sober. I'm not saying that we don't address some of those things even in the steps, okay? But what I'm saying is this physical piece isolated by itself has nothing to do with that. Do you know that my dad, he'll have a surgery. He'll have he's had a lot of surgeries, man. He'll have a hip surgery or a shoulder surgery or a knee surgery or whatever. And he'll get like a bottle of Vicodin. Hope that didn't trigger anybody. And he'll eat like half of them, right? Or as prescribed. And then when he's still got half a bottle left, he'll flush those suckers down the toilet. And you know what he says to me? Man, I just don't like how those things make me feel. And I say, Dad, do you realize that in 2009, I was attempting to sell my organs on the black market for that feeling? I mean, I was seriously looking for somebody that could remove my organs and maybe give me 15 grand for a kidney or something or whatever, you know, a non-essential organ, maybe not a kidney, whatever. I didn't care what it was. Like, I just wanted one of these guys I'd seen in movies that would, like, take you in the back room and, you know, botch you up and remove your organs and give you, like, a big sum of money for them, you know? And I wasn't able to find one, thank God. But he doesn't like the feeling. Y'all ever met somebody that smokes a little weed and they go, man, it just makes me so paranoid and God, I hate that. I'm like, brother, we're having a different experience. We're having a different experience. I'm over here with Willie Nelson and Snoop Dogg with that. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, we're having a different experience. And really, it's not so complicated, guys. It's not so complicated. It calls it an allergy. An allergy is an abnormal reaction. That's all it is. It doesn't matter what happens. It's just an abnormal reaction. Some people, they eat shellfish. Their throat closes up. Okay? Well, I use drugs, and I want to use more. And that's what happens to me. And I have used drugs with hard users, and they were not like me, man. I found them. And I don't even care what the drug is. There's people out there. I have met some hardcore people. Used needles, used glass pipes, did all this stuff. Went to rehab, made a decision never to use again, and didn't. And when they did, they didn't do it like I did, man. I was always amazed at a couple of people that I could find over the years. And they'd take their bag, and they'd put it in their pocket, and they'd say, it's 2 a.m., man. I'm going to go home. I'm done. I'd say, what? What did you just say to me? You know what I mean? I'd say, well, you better give me that. You know what I mean? And I'd start swindling them. Like, I wouldn't let them out of the door. I'm like, well, there's got to be something in my apartment that you want. You know what I mean? Or you know, remember that time that I hooked you up when you were sick? And you know what I mean? Or whatever. Like, you've got that in your pocket and you're just going to go home? You're done? I don't understand that. I don't understand that. But the craving is a funny thing because nobody knows exactly what it's going to take to satisfy it. It's different every time. Sometimes it could be 6 drinks. Sometimes it could be 23 drinks and an 8-ball and a handful of, you know, Xanax. I don't know, you know. But I'm going to go until the craving is satisfied. So I love how it feels, and I have a reaction to it that 92% of people on this earth do not have. They just don't. They don't. I've got buddies that love beer, okay? They love beer, but they don't have a physical reaction to beer. They like to watch football games and drink beer. That's what they do. And if you gave those, if you said, hey, buddy, what's better, 0 beers or 4 beers? They'd say, well, hell, 4 beers. I love beer, so 4 is better than 0. But for me, I have a physical reaction to beer. 4 beers better equal as much as I say I want and whatever else I say I want, or we're going to have a problem. We're going to have a serious problem. And I'm going to start doing crazy things and making up arguments that don't need to happen so that I have a reason to leave, or coming up with excuses to get the hell out of there. Or, you know, you have just set off the physical craving. Right? So it's just important to remember that piece, it's highly genetic. It's like the color of your eyes or the color of your hair or being allergic to something or just being ticklish or not being ticklish or liking tomatoes or thinking they're disgusting, you know? And I've got this thing, okay? And so that's the first part, the physical part. We've got a 3-part illness. We've got a 3-part solution. It's beautiful. It's perfect. So if I didn't have that, I imagine that the issue would have stopped there, right? If I didn't have this thing where when I use, it's a problem. Like if I didn't have this thing where people were like, dude, you can't come over here anymore because last time you came over, you got naked and broke my coffee table. And, you know, we don't like that sort of thing. And, you know, and if I didn't have this thing where I was overusing, there's no problem. Okay, but I do. Now here's the kicker. The next part centers in my mind. And the big book says the main problem centers in my mind rather than in my body. Because even with that physical reaction, the allergy of the craving, if I could just look at that like a sane person, you know, like if I was doing some investments or something and I said, well, you know, when I do that, I lose money, you know, and I'm just not going to do that anymore, or, you know, or whatever. If I could just look at that and say, God, dog, man, these past several years have been just crazy. And whenever I start using, it always gets bad and it gets there in a hurry and it's been getting worse over time. And it's just, you know what I need to do? I just need to stop. I don't need you. I don't need meetings. I don't need, if I could make the decision to just stop, which is why it drives me crazy when you go into a meeting and they say, just don't use and go to meetings. You know, it's like, you don't understand the first step, brother. Just don't use and go to meetings. That's not possible because I'm a mental patient. Okay. I'm Zach. I'm a mental patient. And I've got this thing where when it comes to drugs and alcohol, I've got this obsession and I've got this insanity, and it is more powerful than me, and it is more powerful than the love of my mother, and it is more powerful than my desire to survive. It is more powerful than my desire to pay my rent and have a house. It is more powerful than my desire to have food or water or clothing or shelter. It is more powerful than my desire to stay free and not get arrested and go to prison. It's more powerful than my desire to keep relationships with every single person in this world that I love. It ruled me. It absolutely ruled me. It had me in total bondage, right? And that's something that you don't understand unless you're one of us. I remember one time. Anybody ever had an intervention done on them? Dude, they're fun, man. They're fun. It's crazy. I did this. They had an intervention on me one time right before they Marchman acted me. And I come into the room, and I'm like, oh, what the hell's going on in here, you know? And they've, like, pulled out the big guns. You know, they've got, like, grandma and... I'm like, oh, man, you brought grandma, you know, probably to keep me from getting mad and cussing and flipping tables or whatever, because, you know, I'm going to hopefully not do that in front of grandma or whatever. And they had, like, little letters, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. If frothy emotional appeal would suffice, well, brother, I would have got sober right then and there. Okay, because they had some frothy emotional appeal. They read me these letters, and I was like, oh, my God. I've ruined their lives, you know what I mean? And they loved me, and they trusted me, and I was just a piece of shit. And I should have never been born, you know? And, I mean, it was just like, good Lord, they laid it on thick. And they had pictures of me. They had pictures of me out on the table. And they, you know, it got around to my mom, good Lord. And she picks up this picture of me and she goes, where's this boy? I said, well, that picture's a few years old, Mom. You know, I mean, I'm more of a man these days, as you can see, you know, or whatever. Where's this boy? You know, and they said, and they said, you're not him anymore. You're not him. You don't smile like he smiled. You don't laugh like he laughed. You don't do the things he liked to do. You don't act the way he acted. You don't treat us the way he treated us. We don't even really know. It's kind of like the reverse of the story in the big book where it says, I could hardly bring myself to feel that I had known him, you know, about the guy that recovered. It was like the reverse of that. They're like, we can't hardly bring ourselves to feel that we know you. We think it's you because you look like you're wrapped in this boy's skin, and you know, you've got his skeletal structure or whatever, and you've got his ID in your pocket, but I'm telling you right now, you're not him. And I was like, dang, man, that's deep, you know, like that, like they're telling me, I'm sitting there, I'm high at the moment, you know, and I'm like, are you telling me that I'm not me, you know, or whatever? And they're like, yes, we are. And I'm like, dang, dude, you know? And so apparently I wasn't even me, you know what I mean? And I mean, that's some heavy stuff right there. And, you know, and then it gets to this place where they go around the table and they say, well, do you love us? Yes. Yes, I do. I would be very sad if any of you died. You know what I mean? Yeah, I love you, you know? Well, do you want to be a loser? No, thanks, first of all, you know, second of all, no. I guess you're calling me a loser too, but no, I don't want to be a loser. Do you want to be able to keep a job and have a life? Yes. Yes, that sounds wonderful. You know what I mean? I would love to be able to keep a job and have a life or whatever. Do you want to be able to keep one of these girlfriends that you get? That also sounds really nice. You know, that would be great because they did not have a good track record with that. or their families or anything else. I said, well, you keep going to jail. You know it's inevitable that it's prison. Do you want to get arrested and go to prison? No. No, I don't. I don't, you know. Well, that last time we all showed up there at the hospital, they had all the tubes in you or whatever, and the ER doctor said he'd never seen that much substances in anybody, and you were lucky to be alive. Do you want to die? Sometimes, you know. but you know, no, I'm not actively trying to die. I'm trying to survive, you know. I don't want to die. And then it got to this point where they took all the they took everything, right? And they said, well, then why? Tell me why. Why are you doing it, damn it? I don't know. I don't know. And the book says that. It says we seldom know. You know, sometimes they'll give you one of 100 alibis. The truth is they don't really know. I'm insane. I am insane. Does anybody that's insane know why they're insane? Does anybody that is unable to think rationally know why they're doing irrational things? I don't think so. So I got nothing. I'm just sitting there. I'm a loser. I'm not me. And I have no idea why I'm doing what I'm doing. But apparently I'm going to rehab again. You know? And I'm like, well, all right. There we go. Load me up and take me on in. You know? And they did. And they did. And this mental part is really, really where I'm really, 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 really powerless. And when you read step one, admitted I was powerless over narcotics and all mood, mind-altering substances, right? That's physically. This is one of the ways that you can look at this step. I'm powerless over what happens when I put substances into my body. And I'm powerless over that today as a recovered drug addict. Recovered doesn't mean cured. I can't go out and socially drink and socially use and do any of that because I have an allergy. And not eating shellfish for 12 years doesn't mean you can now eat shellfish again. You know what I mean? I have an allergy. I can't safely use. That has not been cured or fixed. I'm powerless over what happens when I put that stuff into my body. In the next part, it says that our lives had become unmanageable. Well, you know what I couldn't manage? I could not manage the decision to stop and stay stopped. I couldn't. And when I use, everything goes to hell in a handbasket. So everything's unmanageable, right? So I've got this. Somebody told me one time, they said, the only remedy to my malady is complete and total abstinence. But I've got a mental disorder that will not let me completely and totally abstain. So I'm screwed. I'm screwed. I absolutely am 100% screwed. The prognosis for chronic drug addiction and alcoholism is death. That's what happens to most of us. There are miracles that can happen, though, and that's what we need, and nothing short of it. What did Roland Hazard, or what did Carl Jung say to Roland Hazard? He goes, for those of you, most of you probably know, you know, Roland Hazard was Bill W.'s grand sponsor, and he goes to see Carl Jung, who was mentored by Sigmund Freud. And he's one of the greatest psychiatrists of the 1900s. And he's just this absolute genius. He's this amazing psychiatrist. And he's just phenomenal. And Roland Hazard was loaded. He had lots of money, so he spared no expense. He was going to go and he was going to find the problem and he was going to get it fixed. And so he goes and he talks to Carl Jung. Can you imagine sitting in front of Carl Jung? I mean, it would be awesome, right? And he's sitting there and he works on him. He says, I learned the triggers and traps in my brain so good, I thought that there was no possible way I could relapse. He goes back out. He gets loaded. And he comes back to him and he says, dude, what the hell? You told me that I was fixed. I paid you all this money. I did all this treatment. What is up? And he says, the truth is that I have never seen one single case that the problem existed to the extent it does in you, aka real drug addict, real alcoholic, chronic. I've never seen one recover. He's talking to Carl Jung, who sees thousands and thousands of people and has his finger on the pulse of the psychiatric community and knows hundreds of other psychologists and follows their cases and goes to conferences and talks to people. And they talk about, has anybody been successful? And he says, I've never seen one like you ever recover. And he says he feels like the gates of hell shut with a clang. I mean, talk about being screwed. I got to stop, but I can't. And so he tells him that, and he says, to tell you the truth, if you're going to stay sober, you need to hire a bodyguard or lock yourself in a room 24/7. That's all I got for you, buddy. Imagine Carl Jung telling you, look, here's the deal, bro. You're going to have to hire a bodyguard to watch you 24/7, or you're going to have to lock yourself in a room because I've never seen anybody like you ever get clean or sober. Dude, you want to talk about powerlessness? You want to talk about hopelessness? You're doomed. You're totally doomed. And that is that's the way that people felt about us. And then the town drunk, he just died drunk. You know, the town drunk never got sober. That was just you. You're the old Timmy's down there. He's just shit-faced again. And, you know, one of these days we're going to find him on the sidewalk or whatever. And that was it. That's the story. So he says, is there no exception? Is there no exception? He said, yes, there is. Here and there throughout history, people have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. And I'm suggesting that you seek that. That's your only shot. It's a shot in the dark, man. But that's your only shot. So that's when he went out and he found the Oxford group and he found their tenets of action and he recovered, right? But I was told I could go a little bit longer if I needed to. Right? Maybe not too much. Not too much. I'll wrap it up. I'll get to it. Okay. Thank you. So anyways, he goes and let me get back to what I was talking about. So I got off track, man. I told y'all I smoked a lot of weed, man. You know, my brain is probably not healed. So that's what we're up against. Now, the spiritual part of the spiritual problem is not discussed very often. I mean, it is, but there's two. I've heard people that say, no, it's a two-part illness. No, it's a three-part illness. Well, on page 64 in the big book, right after it gets done talking about resentments, it says, for we've been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically in that order. You know why most people don't get clean and sober? Either it's not their time, it's not in God's timing, they're not ready, or they approach this in the wrong order. And I always approached it in the wrong order. Every single time that I went to rehab, you know, the number one thing for me was physical. When they come and visit me after 30 days, I want them to say, man, you've been pumping some iron and getting hydrated and resting. You look good. Because if I look good, I'm doing good, and you think I'm good, and I just want to look good. My number two most important thing was mental. We're paying you good money. This is why we're here. These people are going to fix me. They're going to treat me. They're going to rehabilitate me. And I would want to talk to the therapists and the counselors and the psychiatrists, and I would want them to zap me, and if Carl Jung couldn't do it, it's no wonder that they couldn't either, okay? And then The least important thing to me, if it was even on my radar, was a little spirituality or whatever. You know, I mean, I might let you see me meditating out in the Garden of Serenity or whatever with like one eye open, hoping that you saw me so that later in group you might go, "God, dude, Zach was out in the Garden of Serenity meditating and like I think he's really deeply connected," or whatever, you know, or whatever. But I had spirituality had nothing. It wasn't on my radar even a little bit. Well, this is telling me that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. I'll say this. Golly, I can't believe it's been an hour, man. I'll say this, and then I'll tap the second step. In the doctor's opinion, which hopefully is the same in this book, it's not. Anyways, it says, here it is. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by getting high, taking a few drinks, which they see others taking with impunity. They can do it. Why can't I? So you know what that means? It means that when this is happening, I'm sober. Every time I ever relapsed, guess what I was? Sober. I was clean and sober. So I don't have a drug problem. I do not have a drug problem. I thought that I had a drug problem. I had a drug. What I had was a drug solution to a spiritual problem. Because if I have a drug problem and you take me to detox and remove the drugs from me, drug problem, drugs removed, problem removed, no more drugs, no more problem. Drug problem, no drugs, no problem. Let's go. You know what I'm saying? But then I go out and I'm sober and everybody's rooting for me. You know, everybody's cheering for me. "Man, we really believe in you, Zach. We think you can do it this time. You know, we love you. We want you to do it." And I meant it even when I said it, that I wanted it this time. Maybe I did for a minute. You know, maybe I really did for a minute. I wasn't even lying. And now I'm out there with an untreated spiritual malady and I'm restless, man. I'm sober and everybody loves me and everything's fine, but I'm just restless. I'm just restless. I'm irritable. I'm just agitated, man. I'm discontented. This isn't good enough. I don't know what you think is good enough, but this isn't good enough for me, man. This is no life for me. It's on me. That spiritual malady is on me and I'm stone cold sober and I'm restless, irritable, and I'm discontented. Well, when you realize this is what to me a perfect step one or whatever, a thoroughly experienced step one, what it does is it leaves nothing left but step two. You got nothing left. You don't have to convince somebody who's completely deflated. We're not here to try and convert people or talk them into why God's real or convince them that there is a God or have debates out in the lobby about what's your God of your understanding or anything like that. We don't have to do that. Bottom of page 25, we had but two alternatives. Go on to the bitter end or accept spiritual help. That's what we got for you. If I meet up with a guy at a coffee shop or something like that, and we're talking about if he wants me to be a sponsor, and you know we get to this point, and he's like, "Are you willing to accept spiritual help?" Nope. Then I say, "Brother, I love you. Let me know next time you want to get a burger. There's nothing I can do for you. What am I going to do for you? Give you a pep talk every day to keep you your own mother and your own life and all this stuff, and psychiatrists can't keep you sober, and you think I can? I can't do it. I can't do anything, dude. You're screwed." But when you get to this place where you're like, "Dude, I got nothing." And you're telling me that I can go to most rehabs in the United States in 2021. And when I leave, they say, "Go to a meeting, get a sponsor, work the steps." And you're telling me that this book was written and that 100 people recovered and that now thousands and millions of people have recovered over the last 80-something years. And you're telling me that you did this, and you recovered, and I've talked to you, and you're like me, and you're telling me that that's what I need to do? You don't have to convince them at all. If they're ready, they're ready. If not, they might not be completely deflated. If they're still resisting, they might not be completely deflated. I'll end with this. And we agnostics on the second page. If somebody asks you, "Hey, Zach, what's that book about? What's this book about?" You know, I don't know. what you might say. You might say, it's about how to not drink. Or, you know, I honestly, when I came into the program, I thought that this book was about tricks and tactics to avoid triggers. And, you know, maybe when you feel like you want to get high, scream into a pillow and punch a bunch of it. Don't get hungry, angry, lonely, tired. For God's sakes, don't do that. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to stay sober eating sandwiches, taking naps, and hanging out with people. You know what I mean? That's how you get sober. Just keep it all perfect and just, you know, you'll be fine. And I thought that this was about, like, how to not use. That is not what this book is about. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Obviously. I love that one word sentence. It's so sarcastic. Obviously, you dumbass. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. But where and how are we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. That's what this book is about. This book is about how to find God and get connected to Him so that He can solve your problem. It's about how you can be as hopeless can be, and experience a miracle that nobody but God can get the credit for. And that is why we are so grateful in this room. That is why there's people in here that have been slaving for a year or two to make this conference, because their lives have been radically revolutionized. And they are on fire because they know that they're on borrowed time and that they shouldn't even be here. Yet they're alive, and they're alive, and they're free. They're alive, and they're free, and they're connected, and they're living life. It is miraculous. It is. As miraculous as any miracle you could ever find. You had cancer yesterday and a tumor the size of a baseball in your brain, and now it's gone. It is as miraculous as that. A recovered drug addict is an absolute miracle. And a real drug addict does not get sober without God. There is no other way. There is no other way. It means its main objective is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. That means we've written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral, and it means, of course, we're going to talk about God. I wish that I could talk to you for another 20 minutes about step 2, because I really love it, and step 3, and 4, and 5, and 6, and 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, or whatever. You guys just got me warmed up. You know, I'm pumped. But basically, step 2 came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Doesn't say anything else. Do you believe that a spiritual program of action could be the answer to your problem? Do you believe that? Are you willing to believe that? That's the question. Do you believe that insanity, that restoring you to sanity, is talking about the insanity of the first one? When I'm totally sober and I think that it's a good idea to get high. It's the most insane thing that I could ever do. If I ever get high again, what's happened is I've gone insane. I've lost my connection. I've stopped doing the deal, and I've gone insane. And so we've got this mental, we've got this physical, we've got this mental, and we've got this spiritual malady. And it, the three legacies of Drug Addicts Anonymous, the circle and the triangle, it gives us a three-part solution. We've got recovery, unity, and service. Well, the physical part, we take our bodies, we take them to the meeting. We take them to the unity. We take them to the fellowship. We can't do it alone. We've got to be surrounded by other people that know the truth about themselves and have found the same way out upon which we can absolutely rely. That unity is so important. It is a third of the solution. A lot of times, you know, people that are big book thumpers, sometimes what we do is we'll end up hating on the meetings a little bit. And I've done it. And I'm sorry for that, because, you know, I know that it's not the meetings we make, it's the steps we take. But without the meeting, where would I go? Where would I go? You better believe I'm at my home group every single week. I go to meetings. It's a third of the solution. All right? Well, where do I take my brain, my mind? I take it to the steps in recovery. I apply my mental faculties to working and taking the 12 steps. And then where do I take my spirit? I take it into service. It's how we work our spiritual muscles. It's the nothing will so much ensure our immunity from using as intensive work with others. And so I've got this three-part illness. I've got this three-part solution. And, man, it works. It works. So I would just say, you know, if we're here and we're working through the 12 steps this weekend, hopefully you know the truth about yourself. Are you an addict or not? Just described it the best that I could tonight. And then you know that the solution is a spiritual program of action. You got two alternatives. Keep going on to the bitter end or accept spiritual help if you're like me. Are you willing to accept spiritual help? Do you believe that I believe? Do you believe that this book has helped people? Do you believe that the miracles of people sitting around you, that they believe that? And are you willing to believe that? And if the answer is yes, you're ready to make a decision. You're ready to make a decision. And that's steps one and two. I'll just leave it right there. Thank you very much.
Man, I feel like I was at a pep rally for God. could you imagine me and him doing cocaine together? I mean, he'd be just doing, just talking, and I'll be over here like, shut up, let me talk. But anyway, a couple things real quick.